It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up later, we'll find out about some recent recognition of the International Crane Foundation's work here in Wisconsin and around the world. First, in a late-night vote, the Wisconsin State Senate passed the two-year, $73 billion state budget yesterday. Now it goes to the Assembly, where debate was scheduled to take place today, expected to continue well into the evening. Some changes along the way, including a big one to the state's prevailing wage law. Here with us now to talk more about the budget and what's going on with that law is Sean Johnson, our state capitol reporter. Sean, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Rob.
So you usually join us from the Capitol. You're out of the Capitol right now. It's been evacuated, apparently, due to what's, I think it's being called a credible bomb threat.
Yeah, and that's basically all we know right now. The Department of Administration, which runs the Capitol building and other state buildings, issued a statement saying there had been a credible bomb threat. So assembly debate on the budget had been going on several hours, and I was just cut off abruptly. People were told to leave. And not only told to leave the Capitol building, but told to leave the inner square of the Capitol and cross the street. Madison City Police are here telling people who are actually gathered here for concerts on the square. You got blankets spread out all over the place. Telling people that they needed to leave the square and get across the street at the street while this is happening.
So from what you were able to see before being evacuated, is there a big law enforcement presence searching the Capitol now?
I didn't see it before the evacuation happened. I just stepped out of the building and then got noticed that couldn't go back in. So I'm not sure what's going on inside there. There are police here that have shut off traffic around the building. And like I said, police on foot telling people to leave the square.
All right. Well, we'll be watching for updates on that through the rest of the show. Let's turn to what lawmakers would be doing right now if they could get in there. The state budget, the Senate, a late night vote on the budget plan, 18-15. One Republican senator, Rob Coles, joining Democrats and voting against it. How much had the budget changed from what Governor Walker had initially proposed?
I suppose it depends on who you ask. I think Republicans would tell you it has changed pretty substantially. They would highlight a couple things in particular. I think one that you've heard them talk about today is that they restored a cut to public school funding, state aid, in the first year of the budget. That the governor, it was a cut that the governor included in his budget. They restored that money, so that's something that they've talked about pretty frequently. The governor talked about essentially phasing out Wisconsin's senior care prescription drug buying program. Republicans bucked him on that move, too. So those are a couple examples that they bring out pretty frequently when it comes to differences in the budget. Democrats would tell you the same basic budget that the governor introduced is still there. He introduced a $300 million cut to the University of Wisconsin system. They still have a $250 million cut. He introduced a pretty broad expansion of Wisconsin's private school voucher program. They went along with that expansion, changed it, and actually changed the funding formula so that general aid that would have gone directly to public schools will now flow to private voucher schools instead. So these are arguments that we've been pretty familiar with over the past few months, but they're kind of making their closing arguments today.
One thing not in the budget, it was briefly last week, this change to the state's open records law. The Senate took that out. Other news on that today and yesterday, people confirming that Governor Walker's staff had been involved in crafting those proposed changes. What are you hearing around the Capitol on this issue? Is this still something people are buzzing about?
Yeah, this is something that was really talked about a lot more yesterday when this budget was in the Senate. Because those were still in the changes as the budget went to the Senate, which took it up first. And these were sweeping changes. They would have restricted access to pretty much any legislative communications between other legislators, staff, any research they did for any kind of legislation, bill drafts. All of that would have been closed off and exempted from the state's open records law. It was added to the budget at the very end of the joint finance process on a Thursday night before holiday weekend. There was a huge outcry. Groups on the right and the left said that that was going to make for a more secret government, asking what lawmakers had to hide. And so in the Senate, you had a 32-0 vote to pull those changes out of the budget. That happened yesterday, so they're no longer there. And so the focus of today's debate has been elsewhere.
Talking to WPR reporter Sean Johnson from outside the state capitol, currently evacuated because of what's described as a credible bomb threat. One big change, Sean, prevailing wage laws, sticking point there. What was the compromise that ended up passing in the budget in the Senate?
Yeah, this has been kind of an internal dispute between Republicans for several months now. It's really been the cause that a number of conservative groups have taken up ever since they got their way with right to work earlier this year. And I'd say they pretty much got their right their way with this issue, too. They didn't get a complete repeal of Wisconsin's prevailing wage law, which sets a base wage for government construction projects in Wisconsin. It's based on a survey of what people are getting paid in certain trades. It's used to set a minimum wage or a base wage for construction projects. They got a full repeal of the prevailing wage for local government construction projects starting in 2017. That's a lot, you know, a substantially bigger step than Assembly Republicans had earlier been saying could actually pass the legislature. So, you know, the Senate is a much different place than it was a couple years ago when you had more moderates there that would probably have tamped something like that down. With conservatives in charge of that chamber now, is passed. Had a couple of Republicans vote against it, but it was added to the budget.
So now it's over to the Assembly. Prior to this evacuation of the Capitol, there was a thought that the Assembly could pass this late tonight, I think. Was the hope to have this on the governor's desk by the dawn hours tomorrow?
Yeah, they have these self-imposed time limits that they agree upon with leaders from both parties. So Democrats and Republicans sit down and decide how long they're going to talk on a given issue. And they decided that today they'd be in from, I think it was around 11 in the morning till around 11 or 11:30 at night when Republicans were going to pass the budget. I don't know how this evacuation is going to change that. They could just decide to give it a little more time if we do get back in the building here. So as to when the governor might sign it, we don't know yet. He hasn't said yet. He has a pretty big announcement of his own coming next Monday. He's going to be in Waukesha. He's going to announce he's running for president. So that had been kind of a deadline that not only the governor but also Republican lawmakers have been looking ahead to. They wanted to finish up the budget before that announcement.
And the governor, if he's going to make vetoes, and Wisconsin governors can do some pretty fancy things with partial vetoes, line item type vetoes, is the thought that he would have that done and out before that announcement?
That's what a lot of people are speculating. We just don't know. I mean, he's had most of this budget for about a month now. It had all passed the legislature's budget committee, you know, around the end of May before legislators really just got locked up, Republicans did, on transportation funding, prevailing wage, and a buck arena. That buck arena has been taken out of budget. That might be taken up next week in the legislature. So the governor's had most of this budget in front of him for a while now, and if he was going to make vetoes on that stuff, he could have already, you know, done all his homework on it, gotten as creative as he needs to be. You know, whether or not he still wants to do that this weekend, we'll find out. We just don't know yet.
All right, Sean, before we let you go, are you tweeting about this evacuation as you hear news?
I don't have much news to share, but yeah, of course.
What's your Twitter handle so people can follow at home?
What is it, right? At S. Johnson WPR.
At S. Johnson WPR. Sean, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Reporter. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll find out about two awards that the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo received for their work here in Wisconsin and around the world. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. In Wisconsin, everything goes better with beer, even poetry. Ryan Brown combines his passion for both in events that bring together poets and beer lovers.
The brewing floor of Madison's House of Brews is often bustling with activity, but not like this.
No one else's marginalia inside.
A crowd squeezes in between the kettles, fermenters, and bags of grain. Ryan Brown is the organizer and homebrewer behind Poetry and Pints, poetry readings in unconventional spaces accompanied by beer.
It started a couple of years ago after moving to Madison and trying to figure out how else to get involved into the poetry world here in Madison. And I was already in the brewing world, and it kind of struck me, why not combine those two? Because I love both, and they seem like a really natural pairing and combination. We've done them in Neighborhood Park, Hillington Green Park here in Madison. Backyards, had one in St. Louis that was at a brewery, though not in the brew house. Again, just trying to find places that may not be the typical reading locations.
Four poets take turns sharing poems and stories. Brown is a poet himself, but he wasn't reading on this day. Among those who were was Eau Claire's Max Garland, Wisconsin's former poet laureate.
36 years in Kentucky, and now I've lived 22 or 3 or 4 in Wisconsin. So this is from the Kentucky side of my heart. My uncle was a Pentecostal minister. He also drove a Lincoln Continental, which was as long as this room. It's called Memories of Pentecost. I had an uncle who healed by faith and drove a Lincoln.
Poetry can seem intimidating, but poet Cynthia Marie Hoffman thinks that events like this can help break down barriers.
One of the best ways to get an introduction to poetry for anyone who might feel that way is to come out to a reading. You get to not only experience the poem, but get a little background story about the poem and get that in-between banter that can help really introduce and get a feel for the poet behind the poetry. We're not scary people. We're just like everyone else, and I think we have a lot of fun.
The beer doesn't hurt either.
And beer is the great social lubricant. You know, it's hard to take anything too seriously when you have a tasty beer in your hand. By the same token, people find beer intimidating and new and different. And so it's kind of, you know, my attempt to, get people over that hurdle, whether it's poetry or whether it's a good beer. And we have a good number of people that come out to the Poetry and Pints that aren't the typical poetry reading audiences as well. And it's so neat to walk by and hear a conversation between one of the poets and someone from the community talking about poetry. And then the next conversation, people are talking about beer. And it's just that is why I do it.
Brown hopes to find a way to bring his writing and brewing together.
I'm still kind of figuring out how to write about brewing. In a poetic way, but that's definitely on my mind all the time.
He's already got a title in mind for when he does.
I could be the Brewer Laureate. That would be awesome.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, go to wisconsinlife.org. There are a lot of things that make Wisconsin unique. One of them is the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo, the only place in the world where all 15 species of cranes can be seen, and recently honored for two different projects it's been up to. Richard Belfus is with us now. He's president and CEO of the International Crane Foundation. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, I want to look at two different awards you won. One, closer to home here in Wisconsin, on Whooping Crane Conversation, a project I've been following for a long time. Tell us how endangered the whooping crane is and how you tried to bring it back.
You bet. Yeah, thanks. We've been involved in working with the whooping crane for many, many years now, and the whooping crane is the most threatened bird in North America. It's the rarest bird in North America, and it's also the tallest and one of the most conspicuous, these huge white birds that you see. And we've been involved in two different efforts. One is trying to save the wild flock that migrates between Texas and up into northern Canada, and those birds got down to fewer than 20 back in the 1940s due to excessive hunting and other problems, and they just about went extinct, and then they've been on a very long, slow recovery. Since that time, we're back up a little bit over 300 birds now in the wild, which is an exciting recovery story, but a long, slow slog in trying to bring these birds back. And then as an insurance policy, for about the last 15 years, we've been working on reintroducing a second wild flock into the eastern part of the U.S., and that's called the Whooping Crane Eastern Partnership, working with federal and state partners and other nonprofit organizations trying to bring these birds back to Wisconsin and to the eastern part of the U.S., and that's been a very challenging but exciting project, too. And the idea ultimately is to have a separate population, or maybe two, one down in Louisiana as well, that will buffer against threats across the country to this very, very rare bird.
And that's had some amazing pictures, people dressed as cranes, people up on ultralight, gliders leading cranes around. How big a role do humans have to play to bring these whooping cranes back on this eastern path and to train them on the migration?
Right. It's an enormous challenge to bring species back. You know, it's such a great case for saving them in the wild in the first place, because it really reintroduction is kind of pushing the frontiers of ecology in many ways. It's really testing what we know about what these birds and other animals really need in the wild when we try to bring them back, and how to bring them back successfully and safely. So with the whooping cranes, there were many, many steps to it. We had to teach them a migration route that had been lost when the last of the birds were lost, and that involved that great story with the ultralight aircraft, you know, literally flying them from Wisconsin down to Florida before they could learn the migration on their own. And then it also involves trying to get them to naturally pair up in the wild, form good, strong pair bonds between males and females, to lay eggs successfully, and to raise and fledge those chicks. So there's lots and lots of complicated pieces to trying to get them back, get them into the right habitat, and get them out there. So it's been a lot of work, and there's just, you know, sadly, there's just so few good, successful restoration stories anywhere in the world right now. And we think this is a great story, but we're not there yet. We're still working on it, but we are getting there. So,
you also work with the whooping crane's cousins around the world, and you were recently recognized for its work in Vietnam. You've been into this project for a while, I think. What's the Crane Foundation doing in Vietnam?
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing up this story. It's a great one. We're working in a place called Phu My, which is in the Mekong Delta region of Vietnam, way down in the south of Vietnam. And it's a great project. I think it epitomizes the work we're trying to do at the International Crane Foundation worldwide, which is to find sustainable solutions for cranes that really not only directly affect the conservation issues of the cranes, but address the people that live, and in some places have to make sacrifices in their own livelihoods to live near cranes. So in this project down in the Mekong Delta, we've tried to use the natural wetland grasses that occur around an area called Phu My, and people have been actually harvesting these grasses and using them as wetland plant for decades, for centuries, and using them to weave local products. But we've been working with them to bring these products to market and actually create a good livelihood out of using wetland plants sustainably from this wetland. And what's been really exciting in Phu My is we've got a situation where more households are involved in using these wetland plants, harvesting them sustainably and using them and bringing them and the products to market. And we've got some more people involved. Those people are earning more money, and we've got more cranes. The population of cranes there has shot up as well. There were very few cranes in the site before the project started, and there's more than 250 now using the area, and the number keeps going up. So it's exciting to see these examples where people can coexist with the birds in the wild and find these sort of elusive win-win solutions in the wild.
Yeah, is that going to be a model for people in other conservation efforts, trying to get the local human population on board, make it economically viable, even interesting and exciting for them to join in the effort?
Well, we think so. We think it's a great model for many places where, you know, cranes often, in the crane world, they often live side by side with people, and people revere them, which is wonderful, but they still have to survive and eke out their daily livelihoods in many poor countries where cranes occur. So we're really looking for these opportunities where people can get their livelihoods using the same habitat in many cases as cranes, and use it in a sustainable, in a way that really can be kept in action for the long term. That's what we're aiming for. We think it applies not only to cranes, but many species that live in places where there's lots of people and where you often see conflicts between people and wildlife.
And Rich, before I let you go, when I moved to Wisconsin, the Crane Foundation was here, it existed. I thought, oh, this is just, you know, an institution here. It was just a couple of guys who said, hey, we should start a crane foundation. Can you tell us a bit about the origin story?
Sure. Yeah, International Crane Foundation was started back in 1973 by two students, two Cornell students, George Archibald, who's still with the foundation. He's our co-founder, has served for 42 years, and Ron Sowie, who served for about the first 15 years of the organization and then died rather suddenly back in 1987. And so the vision of Ron and George was to create this foundation and work worldwide for crane conservation, bringing cranes back in the wild where they're missing, but really focusing on saving the birds out in the wild. And a lot of the work that was done in the 70s and 80s was real conservation frontier work, getting into areas like Russia and China and later into Vietnam, where really very few conservation groups were working, and working through this passion people have for cranes around the world to do conservation, to create conservation projects on their behalf. So it was really kind of the genesis of the foundation was this worldwide passion people have for the birds and trying to turn that passion into real action for wetland conservation and grassland conservation around the world.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
That's Rich Belfus. He's president and CEO of the International Crane Foundation based in Baraboo, where you can see and hear the cranes we've been talking about. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up today, a group of Democrats filed a federal lawsuit against election officials over redistricting by Republican lawmakers in 2011. We'll talk to former Republican State Senator Dale Schultz about why he supports that lawsuit. First, a report out last month from the Trust for America's Health revealed that drug overdoses in the U.S. have doubled since 2000. They're now the leading cause of injury death in 36 states, including Wisconsin. Last week alone, the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office recorded 16 heroin-related deaths, an unprecedented increase. The country and state faced what has been termed a heroin epidemic, but the U.S. is not the first country to face such a hurdle. Let's zoom out for a moment and take a look at how Portugal handled a similar situation. Back in the 1990s, Portugal had one of the worst heroin epidemics in the Western world. At one point, 1% of the whole country was addicted to heroin. Overdoses were up. The country had the highest rate of drug-related deaths from AIDS in the European Union. In 2001, the Portuguese government made a big move to try to confront the epidemic by decriminalizing the possession of all drugs, instead sending users to treatment programs. Since then, public health experts have watched the country to see what impact that would have. Recent data from the European Monitoring Center for Drugs and Drug Addiction shows that the country now has the second lowest overdose rate in all of Europe. Back to the U.S. We aren't on the verge of decriminalizing all drugs, pretty far from it, but we have seen an expansion of a criminal justice program dedicated to treatment for drug users over prison time. They're called drug courts. In the past 5 years in particular, we've seen investment in them growing here in Wisconsin. To learn more about how these courts work now, we have Dane County Circuit Court Judge Juan Colas. Judge Colas, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dane County Drug Court Coordinator James Pearson. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
So the mission of drug courts is not actually to stem drug-related deaths. We'll talk about whether that might help in a bit. But Judge Colas, what is the basic mission of these drug courts?
The mission of the drug courts is to reduce criminal reoffending by offenders whose crimes are drug-related or drug-driven in a way that reduces the use of incarceration and increases the use of treatment with the hope of a long-term reduction in criminal recidivism for those people.
And Jim, is it a possible side effect if this program is successful that we might cut down on these tragic statistics we're hearing just this last week of heroin-related deaths in the state?
Yes, yes, most definitely. In drug court in Dane County, we've seen an increase in our participants that have opiate addiction. Over 85% of our individuals are opiate addicted individuals, and that's been growing since around 2006, I believe. That number's been growing, the percentage of opiate addicts that make up our census for the program.
Now, how did drug courts initially come to be here in Wisconsin, Judge Colas?
Well, in the United States, they started in 1989 in Florida. In Wisconsin, the first one was here in Dane County in 1996. Judge Jack Olick began the first drug court, really with that objective of seeing what can I do with these people whose crimes are drug-related and to try to prevent them from coming back into the system repetitively.
Now, did this seem like an alien concept back when it first started? We were coming out of the 80s, tough on crime, three strikes, you're out type policies. Was this seen initially as kind of a weak, soft on crime approach?
At that time, the system operated by referrals from the district attorney's office was primarily a first offender program. I think there's always a little bit of skepticism about new approaches, and including for judges, because it puts the judge in a non-traditional role.
And Jim, how have these grown since those early beginnings with that start here in Dane County?
Well, I know, it began in Dane County in 1996. Looking on the website, Wisconsin Association for Treatment Court Professionals, there's over 28 drug courts in Wisconsin now that have both received both state funding and federal funding through several grants. And then there's also 28 other types of drug courts, including veterans courts, OWI treatment courts, alcohol courts, mental health courts. So this trend has been growing, especially these last few years, as funding has expanded in the state.
And Jim, what determines who ends up going to a drug court instead of a traditional court?
Well, in Dane County, it has to be a felony drug-driven charge. Now, across the state, that could be determined in any different way, depending on how the county or the city wants to look at that. But we focus on those felony drug-driven cases and focus on individuals that this is going to be an alternative for significant jail time or prison time. And so we're wanting to get them involved with treatment, hopefully avoiding that and decreasing jail days, which are expensive, and we can read the reports about increasing prisons and the scarcity of those resources, so that we're trying to divert them from that.
I'll want to get into what exactly happens once people go to a drug court. But first, I want to ask Judge Kolas, from what we know so far, is this successful? Is this cutting down on recidivism?
Well, nationally, the statistics and the research show that there's, on average, about a 15% reduction in recidivism for drug court participants who successfully complete compared with others. There's a wide range of that. Here in Dane County, a study by Dr. Andy Brown at the university in 2011 shows about a 33% reduction in recidivism compared to a non-drug court group with the same demographic profile and statistics. So the programs have been proven effective when they're well conducted.
We're talking about drug courts here in Wisconsin with Dane County Circuit Court Judge Juan Kolas and Dane County Drug Court Coordinator James Pearson. So when they're effective was what you said. They are successful when they're done right. What does done right look like, Jim?
Well, we've set up a program where individuals are intensely monitored. They have a case manager. Their drug tested close to twice a week randomly. Drug tested with our high-risk treatment court program, we work closely with Department of Corrections. And it's that close network that we build, that really that drug court team that makes it successful here in Dane County. We work in collaboration with the Dane DA's office, the Public Defender's Office, Department of Corrections, and Journey Mental Health, and the Circuit Court to make this what it is.
And these are things, Judge Kolas, that the offender might not get, probably wouldn't get if they went through the traditional system, ended up in prison?
Well, that's correct. Whether in prison or on probation, the drug court experience is a much more intensive one in terms of the treatment and the monitoring. A person who's in the high-risk group, which is a particular court that I preside over, will see their case manager and their probation agent once a week. They'll be participating in treatment. They'll be getting the random testing at least twice a week. They may have other particular requirements. So they're getting, it's a much more intensive experience, and it lasts for 9 to 12 months, in addition to the periodic court reviews.
I was going to say, how long does it take someone to graduate? It seems like there's always going to be a risk of relapse, of recidivism, of new drug use, maybe crimes related to that use. Do you keep tracking people who've been through this program after that 9 to 12 month period you mentioned is over?
Well, we do. We track recidivism 2 years out. So in the 2014 report, we would be looking at people who had been discharged in 2012 and whether they had been rearrested or not. So we do follow those statistics. And we obviously we won't know about people who graduated this year until 2017 because you have to allow time to follow that reoffense rate.
And Jim, someone in this situation, someone who's been caught in a drug-related crime, they've been put in this drug treatment system, is the tendency for them to cooperate with the system that's put in place here? Do most people do their best to work their way through this system?
Well, and that's one thing we've tried to do with Dane County Drug Courts Program is trying to get them involved with it as soon as possible. So as soon as they're charged with the case, they're given a screening. And so we have that first contact with them, sometimes within 2 weeks of the case being charged is, but many times within that first 30 days. And then we also 30 days within that, we do an assessment with them and refer them to treatment resources. And that's really what determines best success for that individual for the long run is trying to get to them and to give them those resources right away. And that's one thing that Dane County has done where in the past, it was a lot more delayed process. It could take up to 6 months before they had their first kind of contact with one of our assessors. And now we're in touch with them within close to 30 days and giving them treatment resources as well.
Now, I mentioned that idea of decriminalization in Portugal up front there. Again, we're not on the verge of that, but the idea there being, hey, this is something for treatment, not incarceration. Do you see us moving more and more toward that model of a drug user is someone who needs to be treated, needs help, and doesn't so much need to be punished, doesn't need to be in the incarceration system? Judge Kolas?
I think there's growing recognition that the most effective way to protect public safety in the long term and reduce criminal offending in the long term is by addressing the root causes. And in the case of a person with an addiction, that root cause may be the addiction. And to the extent that can be addressed, the public will be better protected, and that's what we hope to do with drug court.
We're talking to Dane County Circuit Court Judge Juan Kolas and James Pearson, Dane County Drug Court Coordinator. Heroin use up around the country and the state, leading cause now of injury death here in Wisconsin. Talking about drug courts, they're designed to help treat drug users for addiction as opposed to sending them to prison. We're learning how they work, and we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you or a family member had any experience with drug courts, or have you been on the other side in law enforcement or a prosecutor's office and worked with drug courts? Either way, what was your experience like? Do you think this is a good idea? Do you have questions? Do you have concerns about how this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take your calls in a moment after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're back with Dane County Circuit Court Judge Juan Kolas and James Pearson, Dane County Drug Court Coordinator. We're talking about the work that drug courts do to provide treatment options to drug users as opposed to prison time. Drug overdoses up around the country, now the leading cause of injury death in 36 states, including here in Wisconsin. Some data from Europe has shown that this style of intervention can help reduce drug-related deaths. The program aims to keep people from ending up back in prison repeatedly for drug-related crimes. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience in these drug courts? Have you been charged with a crime but then moved to a drug court, or maybe someone in your family, or have you worked on this from the law enforcement or prosecution end? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Travis on the line in Madison. Travis, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Travis?
Yes, as the first graduate of the Dane County Veterans Court, I just wanted to say that I am 100% behind it. I've seen it work more often than not. I've seen maybe one person fail out of a group of about 20 people up and out of Gamey County. And I would have to say that it's turned my life around. I mean, it gave me the opportunity to get out and do something in a more positive light. And I'm ever grateful for it, and I'm doing great.
Was there a part of the process, the treatment or counseling or something that you would point your finger at and say, that's what did it, that's what made the difference, Travis?
What it was the group, having a whole team of people there willing to support you, even if there's not anybody else in your life. You know, having a mentor is probably the biggest thing. It's a big thing in the Veterans Court. And the way it worked for us is they paired us up with other veterans, and it really helps to have someone there going through what you've been through.
Travis, thank you so much for sharing your story, and congratulations. Best of luck to you since you've gotten through that time in your life. Judge Colas, do we have a lot of success stories like that to point to in the drug courts, which I think do similar things to the Veterans Court that Travis was talking about?
Yes, and first of all, congratulations to Travis, because the key in drug court and in the Veterans Court, although we provide support, is the person's own motivation and commitment to make the change and finding what works for them. We do have a lot of success stories, and the Veterans Courts follow a similar model to the drug courts. When Jim was talking about the 28 other types of treatment courts in Wisconsin, veteran courts included, Dane County has just, Judge Flanagan has just started a veterans court here in Dane County that's just getting underway. So we do see a lot of success stories, and it's very rewarding to remember how people were at the beginning of the process when I first met them in court, and then to see them on their graduation day, often bringing in family that they've reconciled with.
Jim, you're nodding along there. Do you see stories like that?
Of course. I mean, it's why we do the work, to hear just what Travis shared. We see individuals that start in the program homeless, unemployed, fractured family situations. And we see that gradual recovery and just that blossoming of their life when they're working. They've reestablished relationships with their significant others and possibly children that they've lost. It's why we do the work. Yeah.
Travis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We go now to Mary with us in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Hi.
Oh, what did you want to bring up, Mary?
Just that I work in corrections, and that I heard the judge say that, oh, these programs are so intensive. And I think there's a disconnect between the judges and corrections, in which we're not capable. Our caseloads are so high. We're really not capable to provide the attention that's necessary. I mean, what I see is people pull themselves out if they can. I don't understand, now that we have this supposed universal health care, why there just can't be treatment available out there. Treatment certainly does work if people apply themselves and see, you know, the downside of continuing in their behavior. But as far as corrections, you know, bringing around this change, we're simply not able, at least in Milwaukee, to provide the attention that's necessary.
Mary, thanks for the call. I want to bring Judge Colas in on that. So, great idea, but we don't have the staffing, we don't have the resources to do this for enough people anyway.
Well, I think perhaps Mary was referring to the ordinary probation supervision that they're able to provide, and I think she's right. I think probation agents are vastly overworked and can't give the kind of attention and provide the kind of resources that people with a serious addiction need. Here in Dane County, in the drug court program, we've been really fortunate to have the full cooperation of the Department of Corrections and the regional office, and they have assigned a dedicated drug court liaison agent to our high-risk group. And that agent is there every week for our court meetings and is supervising all of the people who are in the high-risk treatment group. And so that has made us much more effective. But I think it's true that there are more resources needed for the probation and parole agents who are on the front line of this. And I think, Jim?
Yeah, and I know that also in Dane County, we have a case manager that works closely with that liaison agent, who actually is going to be helping them, that individual, get involved with treatment, where that DOC agent may be very overwhelmed and unable to kind of do the legwork there. Our case managers are well-versed in what's available in the community and help work with the insurances as well, learning where these individuals can go for the help they need.
Mary, thanks for the call. We're talking about drug courts with Judge Juan Colas and Jim Pearson with the Dane County Drug Court System. Now, Mary talked about resources. You were just talking about pretty intensive resources. It sounds expensive. Jim, is this a lot of money? Is it, when all is said and done, worth the investment?
The long-term investment, yes. I mean, when you look at the studies that look at drug courts, how effective they are, and the give back to the communities, unfortunately, I don't know the dollar value off the top of my head, but studies have shown that drug courts are worth the investment, which is why the federal government, as well as states, are investing. You see this growth, not only in Wisconsin, but across the U.S. So, yes, the investment is good. And ACA, the Affordable Care Act, has helped us in some ways. We've had to learn how to utilize that insurance and what's going to be available for those individuals. But it has allowed some flexibility then for individuals that don't have insurance to work with the county and really have them help offer some resources that may have been more limited, that we weren't able to access for them because the county was overwhelmed. They couldn't fund everybody that needed that. And now for our drug court clients, we're finding that this combination has actually been beneficial.
I mentioned the tough on crime era of the 80s and the surrounding decades. Now we're at a point where it seems like more lawmakers here in Wisconsin, Republican lawmakers leading the effort to go more toward treatment than a punitive system. Do you see a cultural, a political change in the way we think of drug-related crimes, Judge Colas?
I think there has been a recognition that we simply can't afford to try to imprison our way out of the problem, that there has to be more than that. So I think that recognition has been seen both at the state and federal level in both parties trying to look for creative, effective ways to protect public safety in a cost-effective manner. And the national figures I've seen show that drug courts properly run return about $2.20 for every dollar that's spent. And that's in direct costs. That doesn't count the indirect costs, the future productivity of the people who successfully recover from an addiction, the effects on family, on future health care costs. That's just direct criminal justice costs.
Jim, what does the future of drug courts look like in Dane County and the state as a whole?
Well, thankfully, Dane County and the city of Madison is dedicated to this idea. In the last year, we've seen the Veterans Court start. In the last 3 years, we've had the OWI Treatment Court was implemented here in Dane County. So you definitely see this influx, not only locally, but across the state, that this is something worth investing in. These are human beings that deserve access to treatment, and this is what we can do to help support that.
And Judge Colas, your hopes as we wrap up for the future of this kind of treatment-related court?
Well, my hope is that it will continue to be supported, that we'll continue to have the resources that we need, that we'll continue to refine our procedures to make it as effective as possible, and hopefully continue to prevent reoffending and putting people in a position to save their lives.
Judge Colas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Dane County Circuit Court Judge Juan Colas and James Pearson, Dane County Drug Court Coordinator, about drug courts, treatment courts here in Wisconsin. As overdoses increase around the state, some data has shown that drug court-style interventions can help stem drug-related deaths and prevent repeat offenses. You can continue the conversation, share your thoughts and experiences over at the Central Time Facebook page.